are so excited to get started in our Aging Well Together show. We're so excited. We're going to be moving into our new studio soon. So, this is one of our last shows that we're doing over Zoom. We're excited to be, though, pre-recording, and we have our great guest with us. Today's show is going to be so interesting. We are going to be highlighting the wonderful aging and health equity research going on at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, otherwise known as NCANT, North Carolina A&T. We have my wonderful friend and colleague here, Dr. Cassandra Germain, with us. She is the Associate Director of the Center for Integrative Health Disparities and Equity Research and Director of the Aging and Well-Being Lab. There's a lot for us to get into. I am excited for all we will learn together. But before we dive into our show, as always, I want to give a shout out to WCOM LP Chapel Hill Carrboro for hosting our weekly Aging Well Together show. You can catch our show every Thursday from 2 to 3 on 103.5 FM or stream us live through WCOMFM.org. And starting next week, you can come by and watch through the windows of the new Drakeford Library in Carrboro and see us do this live. We're excited to have a good window view and be at the library now and see all kinds of folks, but we're not quite there yet. Our Aging Well Together show is brought to you by the always helpful team at the Orange County Department on Aging. Besides being our wonderful sponsors and expert guests on the show, and we highlighted them the last few shows because it was OT, Occupational Therapist Celebration Month, and then it was Social Worker Celebration Month. So the team keeps coming on and it's wonderful. But on top of that, Marilyn over at Orange County Department on Aging takes each of our shows each week and posts it on the Orange County website. So, if you want to catch up on any of our 75 past shows, this is number 76, or find a range of local Orange County aging resources, go to Orange County Department on Aging's website, which is, this is where I slow down so you can all get your paper and pens, www.orangecountync.gov/aging. And if you have any questions about local resources, you can also call the Orange County Department on Aging at 919-968-2070. And if you have any questions about our shows or want to suggest a topic or person or organization, please feel free to email me at agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com. It's all one word, agingwelltogethershow@gmail.com. And listeners, you've been great about sending ideas and topic areas and people, and I love that. A shout out to the Carrboro-based band. We used to call them the Robert Bradford Quartet, but they just came out with their new album, and they are now the Robert Bradford Quintet. And so we need to have them back on, Alicia. They have all new music, but you've heard hopefully just a little bit if you listen to us live as it was streaming. And hopefully at the end of the show, you'll get some more of their wonderful music, original music, and excited to hear what they are up to now. My fabulous co-host, Alicia Reed, is finally joining us for one of our Zoom programs. I'm so excited. Alicia is one of the extraordinary wellness instructors with the Orange County Department on Aging. She is a dedicated community volunteer. She's host of Afternoon Talk with Alicia that comes on right after our show. She's my person. Hi, Alicia. I've missed you.
I'm your color commentator.
You are my
And
color commentator.
yes,
Yes.
color. I like that.
We love that. And then, as for me, I am Heather Altman. I am your host. I've spent over 25 years not hosting the show. We spent 2 years hosting the show, but I've spent over 25 years, it's actually about to be 30 years, working in aging services and supports. I help older adults and their families connect with resources in our community. I'm a caregiver for older family members, and at 54, I am focusing on my own changing needs. So I am super invested in how we are all aging well together. And I am so excited to now turn to our special guest this show. We have our super impressive, my friend and colleague, Dr. Cassandra Germain, with us from NCANT. Dr. Germain is an educator and researcher in the health and behavioral sciences. Her research focuses on identifying modifiable risk factors that are associated with cognitive change, dementia, and functional impairment in later life. Dr. Germain is also interested in behavioral interventions that promote health and emotional well-being in older adults and mentoring undergraduate and graduate students. She was also a dementia caregiver for almost 10 years. And y'all, she's local. I'm not going to give you her home address and, don't tell, she's laughing. Don't tell your social security number. But I knew she worked in Greensboro, but we bumped into each other at Weaver Street Market, and I learned that she lives in Carrboro. So she is one of us here in Orange County. And I'm so excited. As I said, she's in the Department of Psychology, and as I shared before, she is the Associate Director of the Center for Integrative Health Disparities and Equity Research and Director of the Aging and Well-Being Lab. She is all kinds of fabulous. Welcome, Dr. Cassandra Germain.
Hi, Heather and Alicia. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited to be chatting with you guys today about my work and what we do and aging well. So at 52, I too am highly invested in changing things.
Yes.
Things that I
Welcome.
hate my body, so
I know. And because we're not, I'm so excited. One of the things you are missing, which is a good thing, is our old station was very temperature challenged. It was very hot in the summer, very cold, like 32 degrees cold in the winter, even colder than it was outside. So we're so excited for our new temperature controlled lab. I'm in my office now, so I can't complain about the weather, but I'm complaining about previously complaining about the temperature. So we can't wait to have you in the studio with us at some point. But for now, we're going to dive all into your research and your professional work with ANT, but we always like to start with learning more about you. And I know it's all kinds of interesting. Tell us about yourself, where you grew up, and what experiences shaped your current efforts.
That's a great question. So I am originally a Yankee, as they call it here in the South. I'm from New York City. Born in Brooklyn, New York. I've been a transplanted North Carolinian for almost 25 years now. I moved in 2000 and never looked back. I've actually grew up partially in New York City and also South Florida. Well, the Miami of the 1980s, not the Miami of
Nice.
today. All over the media. So a lot of different things have shaped me. I think the biggest influence that got me passionate about aging, wellness, and dementia in particular were my influences as from my grandmother. I was always super close with my maternal grandmother. I spent most of my summers with her, and she's always been a forgetful lady. So funny story. I mean, I think at 7, I might have been the only one thinking about this at 7 years old, but I've been always a little bit of a nerdy, observant child. So I would notice every day before she went off to work, she would look for her keys. She'd be looking for her pocketbook. And it fascinated me because I was like, this is a daily occurrence. Like, this is the only adult I know who goes through this routine every day. And ironically, subsequent, 30 years later, she was diagnosed, typical late onset Alzheimer's disease in her mid to late 70s. By that time, I'd already lost my mother to cancer and had been relocated to North Carolina and had a family of my own. And, I mean, I couldn't imagine anybody else taking care of her but me. So she moved from New York City and lived with me and my family for quite some time. And then I got to see how the other half lives.
Yep.
And made a huge impact on me. So it all kind of came full circle because, observing her in midlife, really got me curious about the brain and what makes people forget. And then I became her caregiver and I got to learn and see firsthand what the experience of being a caregiver is like, watching your loved one change in terms of their ability and their independence, their functionality. And I got to experience firsthand what it's like to be what we call a sandwiched caregiver. So
Yes, we are a scrambled egg sandwich, you and me. We went through that time. Yes.
yes, indeed. So I was a full-time researcher, living in my lab and doing all things objectively Alzheimer's and a mom of school-age children, a wife, and then here I am now adding caregiver So I quickly learned that, what works, what doesn't work, where the gaps are. And, also got me interested in how could I support caregivers better, because I just realized, in spite of all of my knowledge, it really was not very helpful when you're trying to get services, because, we have some work to do in terms of integrating, services for our communities, supporting caregivers, and yeah, there's a lot of work to be done in the public
There
health
so
space,
is.
policy space, to truly go about supporting caregivers. So yeah, that's me in a nutshell. So a lot to say.
There, and I know there's and I've met you, I've met you, some of your friends, and I know that transition. I mean, you were in graduate school with babies. I mean, you really but what I'm struck by is that you saw things, if I understand it, 30 years before they were even diagnosed. I mean, she was that it went from forgetfulness, and then the diagnosis didn't come for so long, but that what you saw personally, you turned into your professional focus area, and how you can support others is just so powerful to me, and I
Thank
think
you.
to others.
Yes, it definitely has a huge impact. I said, she's my heroine, right? And my spirit child and all the things. I lost
So,
her at an age of 95. She
oh
still lived
wow.
a long life, relatively healthy. And I really always try to encourage people to, continue doing as much as you can with your loved one. I mean, they're still there. I mean, the interaction changes, but I always felt that on some level, whether she forgot my name or not, or thought I was my mom or not, she always understood on a deeper emotional, spiritual level that I was there. She recognized me as a family member. She could still do things. Before she became debilitated, we had all kinds of fun adventures together. I took her hiking up Linville Falls in her 80s.
In there. Yeah, that's okay, that's
And
impressive.
even though she had to give up cooking, her favorite pastime, she, loved to do other things. Having humor, being flexible, makes a
Yeah.
huge difference in embracing the caregiver journey. That's
I
for
am
sure.
hearing so much joy infused into what I know was pretty intense, or I'm sure was. And I love how you highlight the humor and the joy and the compassion and the kindness. Now, you are technically, right? We call you a psychologist.
I
Is
am.
that,
I'm a
yes.
developmental psychologist, and my focus is primarily on aging. I have selfish reasons for that,
Well, that's
but.
what I was going to ask. So, in your psychology journal, journey, is it like, did you start out right from the get-go saying, because of my personal experience, I want aging to be my thing?
Yes, I
Yeah.
actually did. Yep. I always knew that that was the space that I wanted to work in. I knew that I always wanted to be an aging researcher, and I never looked back.
I love that focus. I joined just a few, you came down in 2000, I came down in 97, but when I started my public health journey at UNC, I was like, yeah, I want aging. Look at us being so smart and knowing what was going to be important, not just to ourselves and to others. So you have all of this background experience, you put it into your professional. Tell us about the center. I do, as Alicia knows, I like to say, I like to stalk our guests. And I went on to the website, and the center's description and mission statement, it's really, it's long, so I won't read all of it, but it's very impressive. And I love one part that I'll just say is I was drawn to the statements, health disparities and equity research is complex and multifaceted. And to work towards the alleviation of this, the disparities, the center formulates new, relevant, and transformative research theories and models to bring greater clarity and understanding to health disparities and health inequities, to bring solutions for their elimination. So I didn't want to do a gotcha moment, so I went ahead and read what I found was so powerful from the website. But there's so much in that. How do you talk about it in very just like normal, that's very sort of academic terms, and there's so much lofty goals in that. But how do you describe the center over cocktails?
Yes, so the way,
Yeah.
yeah, great question. So the center really was designed with this whole idea about, kind of putting a different lens. So, for a long time in the research world, academic world, even in the policy world, there's been kind of an understanding that, where you age affects how you age. Life experiences can impact you. So if you're, in the Northeast where you walk and take public transportation everywhere, you're going to age differently, and have different health outcomes and access to different things, than if you were raised in the South, where or the a region that we call the Stroke Belt. And the same thing goes for, are you living in urban, suburban, or rural areas? So just, acknowledging that, people's health and well-being, people's access to quality health care, health, all of those things are exemplars of health disparities. Of course, your gender, your sex, your race, the place in which you age, all of those things are very complex, and they all contribute to our health and our well-being overall. So our goal is to really take an interdisciplinary approach and multidisciplinary approach, just like I were talking about caregiving. It's very parallel. There are a lot of things that go into being able to support a caregiver effectively. And I would say the same thing happens in terms of addressing health disparities and improving health equity. So from our center, we create, public-private partnerships. Not only within academia, we also collaborate with public health in our region here in Greensboro with the public health department, with stakeholders, with primary care, because we really want to have all voices at the table. We also have a community advisory board so that we understand what's going on in various communities. Because again, where even within the same city, we recognize that there are variations in what people have access to, their knowledge and awareness about health and contributions to health disparities and how they should take care of themselves. We have an MOU with Cone Health to try to help address health disparities in within the city of Greensboro and surrounding areas. So again, our mission statement really speaks to the fact that we want to that we acknowledge, number one, that health disparities is a complex issue, and sometimes a systemic issue, and that we need all voices at the table so that we can, think about creative solutions and to implement solutions that meet the community's needs. Because again, not all communities' needs are the same. A great example of that is here within East Greens in Greensboro. We know that within about a 3 to 4 zip code area, there's a 10 to 15 year life expectancy gap. And I'm talking about just within a
Wow.
5 mile radius. And that's one of the initiatives and the goals that we have in working with partners such as Cone Health and the Public Health Department, kind of figuring out, what are the needs of the community? How can we improve, access to wellness, which includes education, partnership, and kind of meeting the community's needs again to improve, access to quality health care, health education, and to improve health equity and long-term health outcomes.
Okay, there's so much there that was fascinating. And so, I have follow-up questions. But one question I was already going to ask you about, and you sort of linked right to it, was about your impressive list of stakeholders. Because I did see that when I looked on your website. And it does highlight, as you talked about, your work with community stakeholders. So you have research stakeholders, you have academic stakeholders, healthcare, but also community members to build sustainable and trusted relationships. And you highlight your work with minority ethnic groups and economically disadvantaged populations. And I think that disparity in life expectancy, I don't realize there's so much a disparity within the same community. So when you're working with these different populations that bear the burden of disease, and I know from my own community organizing efforts, it can be really challenging and complex, not just the work you're doing, but to build those relationships, especially
Absolutely.
coming from a university standpoint and that sort of ivory tower going into the community. What lessons have you learned, or are you welcomed? Because we're in an academic town, right? now where you live, and I've done community work, and sometimes populations are not happy to be looked at as, you're just coming in to see our problems, and we're guinea pigs, and you just jump in and jump out. So I am wondering about your work and how it's been welcomed or not.
Well, I would say, yes, those are excellent questions. And I think all of us who are in academia and who do anything with the community understand that number one, I mean, trust is a huge factor. It doesn't matter if you're working in a rural community, if you're working in a ethnically or racially diverse community, immigrant community, you really have to establish trust within that community. You have to approach it with a lens of respect. I think in previous work or historically, communities have not really welcomed academic institutions, for some of the reasons that you've already mentioned. So number one, this lens of, we know what's good for you, or
Yeah.
we have these wonderful
That
ideas.
paternalistic and patronizing and yeah.
Yes, very paternalistic framework. So I would say, what's important is one, we also engage our community advisory board. So we have not only stakeholders from the community who are doing grassroots efforts, but we also have, laypersons on our community advisory board, so that we can have adequate representation. Find out what does the community need, what are their pressing issues, so that we can help to identify, what initiatives we're going to take. Because yes, I mean, it can definitely be perceived, and it is a huge roadblock when you're perceived as kind of being here just to, impose your will or to collect data without trying to meet the community's needs. So it definitely is a give and take. I think we here at ANT are lucky because North Carolina ANT does have kind of like name recognition in the region. And I think being embedded in the community helps to give us a bit of an advantage. But we also don't ever want to abuse that advantage. We kind of try to approach it very differently. Again, hearing people's voices, asking them what they need, and seeing how those things can become, symbiotic relationship. So at our center, we have four primary, health initiatives. So
Oh, perfect. I was just going to ask, tell us about your
read your
priorities next. So
mind.
you're on it.
I read your mind.
I know.
So we are our four primary health initiatives are around cancer, cancer awareness, cardiometabolic health awareness. That includes things like, diabetes and hypertension, maternal and child health, as well as aging, which is, my area of expertise. But even though we have our four primary areas of focus and interest, we addressed how we educate the community, how we promote outreach efforts and targeted interventions based on that feedback. So our goals and our focus are never going to supersede what the community needs. We try to combine it with what they say that their needs are.
That I was going to ask, and then Alicia, I will be quiet in a second if you want to ask a question. But yeah, I was going to ask what the link is between your community advisory board and your stakeholders and their goals and priorities and how that intersects with your priorities. And I do, you used a really fancy term, very impressive sounding, and it was a term I've actually never heard before. So what did you call it? That was it metabolic disorders that I've heard diabetes. What did you call
Good.
that?
Well, yes. So we call it's a cluster of diseases. I call it cardiometabolic diseases. So basically, those are exactly, that's why I talked about diabetes. So
Yes.
diabetes, hypertension,
Yeah.
more, obesity, right? Those are all examples of what we call metabolic conditions, things that have to do with your metabolism, things like that. So we call them, and the reason that they are termed cardiometabolic is because these are all things that are related to heart health and our cardiovascular system.
I love that. While we like to use lay terms on aging well together, we do I'll own this. I do geek out every once in a while. So while we generally do talk about, and we've had shows on heart health and diabetes and all those other issues, I love the kind of more scientific researchy term cardiometabolic diseases, because I do like that it's an umbrella and it does kind of focus on so many things. Alicia, did you want to jump in? I know I'm asking all kinds of questions, but honey, what sort of commentary?
I guess I'm coming from the layman. How do you bring the community into what you're finding that's needed? How are you getting them to be involved in the cardiometabolic disease health to make, where are they coming from? Is it just students or is it?
Great, that's a great question. We use all the lenses, right? As I mentioned before, our center is interdisciplinary. So in addition to community stakeholders and academics, even within our departments, we do engage faculty, we engage students. We have faculty affiliates that come from the built environment. You might be saying, hey, what does that have to do with anything? Engineering, psychology, social work, nursing, again, because again, aging in place all influences. So we really have all hands on deck. And we do it in very different ways. A couple of examples. We try to engage the community, let's say in my lab, because my lab, the work that I do around aging with my lab, the Aging and Wellbeing Lab with my students, also kind of spills into the center's initiatives, right? For obvious reasons. But one of the things that we started doing, is going out into the community to do health education around Alzheimer's disease and brain health. Because one of the things that I discovered over the past couple of years, even though everyone is familiar with the term Alzheimer's disease, dementias, I was getting a lot of questions from the community, from friends, from family members, just asking about, well, so and so says that my aunt has dementia, but they didn't say Alzheimer's disease. What is the difference? What are some of the risk factors? So I was recognizing that the more I spoke with people, that there were a little bit of disconnect in terms of what people understood about Alzheimer's disease. So number one, a lot of people miss the early warning signs. And by the time that they're going to the doctor or getting a screen, they're really in full-blown dementia of some sort. It could be Alzheimer's type dementia, right? Which is usually a longer progression, like what my grandmother had. Others may have a vascular dementia or Lewy body dementia or a different kind of dementia that has more of a quicker progression. But I realized that I was getting these questions all the time, and I said, wow, we're kind of missing the mark a little bit. And we need to change our messaging and how we're talking about it. So one of the initiatives that we have through the Aging and Wellbeing Lab, we've been partnering with our community partners. We were heading out to all kinds of places, public libraries, housing projects. We're going to active adult centers throughout the community, and we're doing kind of like these lunch and learns, which is really fun. So we've developed kind of like a little true false brain trivia quiz that kind of helps people learn in real terms. So it asks different questions about, what do they understand about the early warning signs, some myths about aging and memory, like, is it normal for you to get lost in a public place that you're used to going to? So it's kind of twofold. They're kind of learning and they're having fun with this little trivia, but we're also, helping to debunk some of these myths about aging. And what we found from our research, and we're going to be publishing this paper soon, is that surprisingly enough, there are still some aging myths out there.
Ooh, like this is fun. I love that we're getting advanced. You're giving us some tea. You're giving us
I'm
some
giving you just
insights
a
on
little bit of
advanced stuff. So,
tea.
what are those? We love myth busting here. What are some of those myths? And listener, these are myths. If you're listening to it doesn't mean that it's true.
Aging myths. So people, number one, are still believing, a good number of people, like 30 to 40%, think that, forgetting common words is a normal part of aging. So, and we try to say it's like the tip of the tongue. So tip of the tongue is like when you know the name of someone or something and you're about to say it and it's just slipping your mind in that moment, that's very different than just kind of forgetting common words. So if you're forgetting things like table, chair, desk, things that you interact with every day that isn't considered a normal part of aging. And if that's happening frequently, it's something that you should go and get checked out. That's very different for example, where you might forget a cousin's name that you only see at family
Oh,
reunion.
I lost a trivia question yesterday. It was the actor in Saturday Night Fever, and I knew it was John. I could not come up with the name John Travolta, and I was like, that is so much of my generation. Why couldn't I come up with it? So for me, so that falls under normal aging, right? That if you just can't, oh, what was that actor's name? That's okay, as opposed to what am I holding? And I'm holding a pen.
Oh,
Absolutely. So that's a perfect example. Yes. So things like that are not, and also getting lost in familiar places. That was one of the ways in which I was able to convince a long distance family member that, hey, grandma needed to get screened because I picked it up right away, of course, because, right, this is what I do. And we had a relationship. So we talked every day and I started noticing the early warning signs, but she was still living independently. And when I talked to my uncle, I was like, hey, she needs to get screened. These are the things that I'm seeing, and these are not normal signs of aging. He completely ignored me. And then one day she hopped on the train, she went to Midtown. And she couldn't remember how to get back. And she's never driven a day in her life. She's only known the subway.
oh,
So,
classic New Yorker like my grandmother. Though
yes,
the
that's
Bronx, that was the Bronx and Yonkers, not Brooklyn. But yeah,
absolutely.
classic. A lot of people aren't driving, but they got interesting.
Absolutely. So it wasn't until that happened that he kind of took me seriously. And since she hadn't relocated yet at the time, he had to be the one to get the screening done. So those are examples. So that is not a normal part of aging. So driving to the local grocery store where you've been a thousand times and not remembering how to get back, that wouldn't be considered a normal part of aging. So we are learning about this as we're educating the community. Again, we always try to take a symbiotic approach. We are helping them to understand, what the different types of dementias are, how they progress differently, why it's important to get screened early. So I always like to tease my audience. And I was like, the very reason why you're afraid to get diagnosed is also the very reason why you should get diagnosed. Right? Right? Do you guys agree with me on that
Yes.
one?
Oh, and we're coming right into June, Brain Health Awareness Month, and last year we had a series of neurologists on. And it used to be, kind of don't ask, don't tell about your own dementia changes because there was really not a lot to be done, people felt. But now there are, especially with the new medication where you're supposed to be treated early, there's actually
Yes.
now a change in the past year or so of people realizing there is a reason besides behavioral interventions, which I know you and I are a fan of, and more of our training, but there's now medication that can be kicked in a lot earlier. So I think this kind of hiding, is not helpful anymore. Hiding
Exactly.
from
So
yourself.
yes. You actually took the words right out of my mouth. So
Oh,
that's
I'm
one.
sorry.
No, I love it. So that's one of the main primary reasons. I mean, in order for you to benefit from the medications, it's important to get diagnosed early, so that it can slow the progression. That's number one. And this month we've been talking about healthcare decisions, right? You
Yes.
want to make decisions about how you're going to progress and transition and age in place or not age in place, while you still have the capacity to. I always tell people that, all traditional, typical onset Alzheimer's disease has a kind of like what I call a longer lifespan. Like I said, my grandmother got diagnosed at, kind of like a what we used to think of as typical, right? 75, 77. She lived to be 95. Her sister, on the other hand, who was diagnosed with vascular dementia, within 3 to 5 years of diagnosis, right, she was able to move on. But she also had a more complex medical history. So we love having autonomy and making decisions for ourselves. And the sooner the more you're able to maintain that control and to make positive healthcare decisions for yourself. Decide who's going to handle your finances. What do you want your last days to be? Do you want to be at home? Do you want to be, in long-term care? How are you going to think about how this is going to impact your spouse or your loved ones? So there is power in knowing early. So I always tell people again, knowing is half the battle.
I first of all, Thank you for so much, but really thank you for doing a shout out. We were talking about how it's OT month, but it's Healthcare Decisions Month. I actually have the proclamation right on my wall because in our Cassandra and I worked together with the North Carolina Serious Illness Coalition, and we had Governor Cooper proclaim April as North Carolina Healthcare Decisions Month. So, thank you so much for using some time, and I'm just gonna join right in there. This is of every month's important, but really this month is the time to talk with your families about what your healthcare preferences are. Name someone who can speak for you if you can't speak for yourself, and get your wishes out there. If you want more information for that, it's funny, I'll go and then I want to do your website. Go to www. NCSICoalition.org, North Carolina Serious Illness Coalition.org, NCSICoalition.org, and there's a whole part on advanced care planning. But I'm so glad you brought that part up. And first of all, I'm wondering, when is your paper coming out? Because you said it hasn't, is it, are we going to be able to do it soon? Because I have clients whose family members are struggling with accepting that this is not normal aging. And so I'd love to have more research to be able to share that what and a doctor has said, mild cognitive impairment. And so what I was trying to say is when they've said it, they mean it. Mild cognitive impairment or moderate cognitive impairment is not normal aging. Like, that is something to listen to. They're like, it's just mild. And I'm like, yes, but it's still something that
Yes,
needs to
and it
be
can
attended to.
progress, right? It can progress. So, yes.
Oh, are there other myths that we just because we love myth busting here, or if there's
Let's see.
others, think about it.
Can I ask you another question? Do you find people are uncomfortable, like the five wishes and where you're bringing this topic up? Are you finding people still uncomfortable about the realization of it being necessary or it being a part of life? You still
Yeah,
get people.
it's yes and no. I think it's a mixed bag of tricks. There are still some resistance to kind of knowing a little bit in certain communities. Some people are very fearful, but I always feel that, people are afraid of the unknown. I think that's human nature. So this is my psychologist hat coming on. So, it's human nature. People are afraid of the unknown. And I think that the more people understand and learn about it, it kind of takes the mystery away from it, and people are more receptive. When I go out and I talk about these things, I get lots and lots of questions about people's own personal experiences with their family members, or what they're noticing about themselves that's changing. So I feel like once you take the shroud away from it, like the mystery, they're more interested in asking questions, especially when I say something like, we've got like 10 different types of dementias. They're like, really? I did not know that. Tell me more. And also approaching it from different things. In our research, what we found so far is that a lot of people are still unaware about how much of an impact that chronic diseases, what the especially the big three, what I call the big three, right? Heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, what a huge impact that has on brain health.
The
So a lot of
cardiometabolic diseases, Dr.
yes,
Spain, that you've
look
taught
at
us.
you. You're using those that fancy terminology
Yes. I
together.
like that. Yeah. Use
Absolutely.
that. I like that.
But
So
yes, as you were saying, so they do have an impact, even though it's your cardiometabolic, it has an impact on your neurology, on your brain health.
absolute huge impact. Even more so, for certain types of dementia than genetics. So, eating well, staying active, managing or preventing chronic diseases like diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease are super important. And just being knowledgeable about that. And I had an experience recently which, saddened me, but also reinforced my motivation to keep doing this, public education and outreach work. Last month, I went out to one of our active lifestyle centers for older adults out here in Greensboro. And we started because of what we learned, right? People are not getting the connection between chronic disease with brain health. So our new series was less focused on dementia, but more about chronic disease and its relationship to brain health. We went out and we did a series about heart disease. And a week later, I got a phone call from a woman who, was in tears, but was also moved to action that, the week after she came to our lecture, she lost her daughter, who lived in
Oh.
South Carolina, to a heart attack because she missed the early warning signs and symptoms. So she was, of course, heartbroken, but really motivated to get the information out there to her family. But she also turned that tragedy into something beautiful. She came and gathered a lot of health information from us around heart disease in women, the early warning signs, and how it's related to brain health. And she brought that to her daughter's memorial service because she recognized,
Oh, wow.
I
Yeah,
that's a wow,
And
and her.
so raw. I mean that it happened and in that intensity that she could bring it to the memorial. I was thinking, this was months,
Wow.
years after, but oh,
No,
wow.
literally within 2 weeks. And when I got her voicemail, I had to sit with myself for a minute because it was just so shocking. I mean, I can only imagine it was even
Sure.
truly shocking
Yeah.
for her. But it just was so relevant and it was so fresh. And but I really, found it really empowering for her
It
to
was, I think,
it's a
very
moment.
empowering.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so speaking of interesting cognitive things, I need to do a quick program note or change. So
Yes.
I said the wrong governor's name. I realized I was looking at last year's proclamation. This is the second time I have not said Governor Stein and I said Governor Cooper. And Governor
Gotta get
Stein
it for that.
he's from our town. I know his parents, I know him. I'm so sorry, Governor Stein did the proclamation. So we're going from the really powerful story you just shared to mine. But I do feel like when the listeners say, "Did you just say Governor Cooper?" I'm having my own cognitive, but maybe hopefully aging and multitasking issues, not
No, it's
yeah.
called
finding something.
familiarity. I have an answer for that as well. But you know what's so funny is Alicia and I didn't catch it either. So, right? So we're already saying,
I
well,
know,
you
and
know
I'm looking.
what? I heard her say Cooper and I thought, Cooper, That's odd.
Oh,
That my brain just said Cooper.
and because I'm looking at it, and they were so nice, and I have the new one, and I haven't put it on my wall yet, but I'm looking at last year's. I am so sorry.
Yeah, I thought, wow, Cooper
So
signed that?
speaking of politics, and we have a little time left, and to the extent that we can talk about this in an appropriate way, whatever you want to share, you use lots of words that are so important and are so fundamental, but have now become hotbed words. Health
Absolutely.
equity, health disparities, and marginalized populations,
And women.
and women even. Yes. How are you able to continue? Like,
And you.
how is this going? How is it impacting you, your
Yeah.
work, your research?
Right.
Well, you are very right about that, Heather. I will say to you that. We in the entire academic world who do this kind of research and this work, we are monitoring the day-to-day situation and changes very closely. It does sadden us that we've kind of come to this space, but I will say our resolve to continue this kind of work really. Is not impacted because before DEI became popular in a buzzword, those of us who are involved in public health, health education, in serving these communities, we were already doing that before these terms and this work became popular, weren't we, Heather?
And I mean, it's a perfectly fair conversation to say different communities, different populations of people are being impacted differently by
No
different diseases
questions.
or different situations. And it's the point of healthcare, it's the point of public health to look at the health of a community and say, huh, how come some communities are experiencing things differently? Are there ways we can impact that either the environment or behavior or medication? So, but somehow when words got, and then, so yes, for us for a long time, it was health disparities and health equity work. And then, and so somehow DEI and health equities, it became a buzzword in a problematic way. But I was just with a colleague an hour ago, a public health colleague, and for years in order to get funded, in order to have your work being looked at. You had to say how you were addressing health equity or diverse populations and making sure you weren't just making generalizable comments that really aren't generalizable. How many more scientific terms can we throw in here? But
Absolutely.
now it's a little intense. Like,
Very
how do you tie,
intense.
especially when you can't mention the word women?
Yes, exactly. So, as I said, I feel like the spirit of our center will not change. These are the communities that we serve. Again, I mean, you because you said you know people who've never driven. If you don't live in a community with sidewalks or with green space, you're not, and you don't have a yard, you're not going to be able to exercise. You're not going to be able to walk. That's going to impact, your health. Whereas if you do, so I mean, the realities are not going to go away about that communities are different, within a state, within a city, within a county,
Within
a country.
I'm jumping in, sorry, within the region, because you and I are both from the Northeast. There's the South is called I love how I forgot, we're called the Stroke Belt. Well, what is that? What makes the Southeast different than the Northeast? Or do we want to not know that? I think people want to know that so that way, I mean, these are deadly issues. I think people want to prevent stroke. And so it's like, okay, what words are you comfortable? Because I think most people are in agreement. We want to prevent stroke. We want to prevent cancers. We want to have improved brain health and heart health. So what language are people comfortable in making sure that we can do that in a way that helps everyone and
Absolutely.
doesn't tick off people, but like tell us the words to use. But at the end of the day, I think the intent, I would have a, it'd be a hard thing for seeing people not agree with, like, yes, strokes are problematic. It'd be nice to have less of them. Dementia is really complicated. It'd be nice to know how to address this.
Absolutely.
But
Yeah.
what's going on to me with money? Is there like a fear of budgets being cut so that the money's not coming in to help these programs continue to maintain in communities that really need them, or who are looking forward to gaining information and everything. So what about the money? Is there a threat
Yes,
in
absolutely. I
what you
mean,
do?
these things have already started, across, our university system. We are part of the UNC system. We're already seeing some people have had their funding already pulled or halted, because they are not aligned with, the current policies, and they violate the new executive orders. So people already are being impacted directly. And what's really heartbreaking and sad, I mean, not only, our research is being impacted, but our communities are going to be impacted. Our students are being impacted as well. Some of them are losing their funding, their scholarships. We had a student recently deported from the UK, which don't understand that, given that they are our allies. So there are a lot of changes happening very quickly. We, just like everybody else, are monitoring the situation, trying to make sense of what's happening and trying to figure out ways in which we can continue our work, how we can continue to support our communities and continue to support our students as well.
I was excited for us to talk today because I'm like, is there some pushback on the name of your center? I mean, like, here's this name.
I'm sure they will be.
I was like, right there. I mean, it's wonderful to be looking at the Center for Integrative Health Disparities and Equity Research. And those words are interesting words for people now. So I was, or just call it CIDR, as the
We're
acronym.
waiting for guidance on that.
So
I'm
you
sure.
may have to change your name.
Pardon?
You may have to change your name of the
We
center.
may be required. Again, we are part of the UNC system. We receive funding, which in turn receives federal funding. So we are awaiting directives on
Just
that.
call it Germaine's lab. Just call it. And if am I incorrect? Isn't North Carolina A&T part of the HBCU system? Is it considered an HBCU?
Yes, North
I
Carolina
thought it
A&T,
was.
HBCU,
So
yes.
you have not only are so you're a public a university, but I am, and that when we were talking earlier about partnerships with community, I was wondering whether there might be more power, more trust, more respect because you are part of an HBCU and you're going in certain populations that might be more of a an accepted. So I was thinking about that earlier, but now in the current conversation, in terms of what universities might be more targeted or frankly more protected because it's part of the focus areas. I don't know. I just know there's a lot happening. It's
Don't
changing
think any of us
hourly.
know. Yes, we are. Again, yeah, I don't think any of us know. So we're trying to figure out what that's going to look like for us because, again, we are a land grant institution.
Oh, that
So
too. Got a lot of things. Yes.
we've got a lot of things. So we are an HBCU, a land grant institution, part of the UNC State University system. So we wear a lot of hats. I think, like you were talking about the trust, yes, we are an HBCU that does give us an advantage, but we're also physically placed in East Greensboro. So we are embedded in the community. We kind of straddle two communities. So we are physically embedded in the community, one of the communities that we serve. So
Well,
all of these things come into play in terms of being able to establish trust, reach out to the community, leverage our partnerships. And we're all waiting with bated breath to see how the rest of this shakes out.
so we have just short of about 5 minutes left, and so I want to turn from areas of concern to areas of hope. So looking at the future, and that future could be tomorrow, or that future could be in more of the
Next.
future. What does, especially in this really complicated time, what does give you hope in terms of any of the areas that you're addressing with your professional work, your research, things you're seeing personally? What gives you hope for the future? Yeah. So listeners, again, we have a radio show, not a TV show, and she just sort of put her finger to mouth okay. And also, I don't know what that was, a or a shush, but
Well, it's definitely an I would say I really just focus on meeting the community's needs and focusing on students. I think my personal strategy, I can't speak for anybody else, is just focusing on what needs to be done. Again, we've always done this work. I'll continue to do this work. Students need mentoring. We need to prepare the next generation to continue this work. And it's something that I'm very passionate about. These things are not going to change. So I do feel that we just have to weather the storm, however long it is, and be like, the steady ox in the storm and just continue to that we do. So I feel like, there's always room for optimism. Cautious optimism right now is what reigns, but focusing on the work gives me joy. Focusing on my students gives me joy on the community's needs. Again, it may not get funded, but the work will continue. And I have some exciting. I'm going to take 21 students abroad to Europe in about 2.5 weeks to study the history of psychology. So
Where are you doing? I want to come. Wait, where are you going in Europe? And I was like, history of psychology. Are you going to Greece? No, that's not Europe. Where are you going?
Not at all. Actually, believe it or not, a lot of modern day psychology comes to us from Europe. So we're going to go to Vienna. Freud.
Oh, yes. Okay.
We're going to go to Vienna. We're going to go to London, and we are going to go to Amsterdam.
How do we get in on that? So, are these your grad students?
So we're taking undergraduate and graduate students are eligible to go. So it's really a wonderful opportunity for them to travel, to see how health and healthcare is approached, outside of the country, how mental health is approached differently, and also kind of see where some of the roots of our theories come from. We'll visit both of Freud's homes in Vienna, pre-World War and post, and in London. And do all kinds of things. We'll be visiting the original mental health hospital, which were tied to local churches. So we'll be having lots of fun and educational opportunities in the next coming weeks. So things like that always keep my.
Oh, I love that. My daughter's an art history major. One of my daughters, she's going to be in DC next week with one of her class, and then later on in the summer, going to Scotland to look at art and architecture. So I love that you can, especially during these crazy times, focus on students and moving forward and education and adding some really great fun tourism and seeing where it happened. Oh, I love that. All right, I have to wrap us up a little bit. Anything that you didn't share? Oh, you know what we didn't share? Your website. Could you share your website so people, if they want to learn more?
Yes, absolutely. They can go to www.agingwellbeing.com, I think slash Wix.
Oh,
And
like
that is
WI, you gotta spell WIEX.
WIX. So that's the website. But actually, an easier one would be to follow the Aging and Wellbeing Lab on Instagram and Facebook. I think that's going to be easier for them to find us. And if they want to get more information about our Center for Integrative Health Disparities, they can go to www.ncat.edu and backslash, and then they'll find a center. If they type in CITER, we'll pop right up.
All right, well, because I got to wrap us up, I will also add it to our website when it goes next to our podcast, episode 76. I cannot thank you enough, Dr. Cassandra Germain. Thank you so much, Alicia
Thank you,
Reed. Thank
Alicia.
you. It was so wonderful to be together. Thank you, WCOM, LP, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, for hosting our show, Orange County Department on Aging for sponsoring our show, and always listeners, thank you so much to you. And we look forward to the next show. All right, take care.